Blog Talk Radio.
This is Fighting Bob Radio. I'm Eric Schubring with the founder of FightingBob.com and the Fighting Bob Festival, which comes up on September the 7th this year. Ed Garvey, good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Eric. How are you?
We're doing very well. The sun is shining. We're not having a snow day in the north, but high water is an issue in many parts of northern Wisconsin. We have been getting so much rain that the just getting a bit of sunshine is a pleasure.
You're not kidding.
People were questioning what it was at first. And is that a sunset where we're actually seeing the sunset? The weather has been unusual, to say the least. And, of course, we're with the journalist David Giffey. David, how are you?
Good morning, Eric and Ed. Good to be here. I'm fine, thanks. And it's cool and wet here as well.
Well, it's not wet here, but the ground is wet, but the sky is clear, and we're just so grateful for it as we head into this Memorial Day weekend. I guess we'll have some good weather. Coming up this hour, as you know, we'll be talking with Paul DeMaine of News from Indian Country and Indian Country TV, and he's also very much involved in the Pinoki Mountain Education Project and work that the Bad River and other tribes are doing to stop any development of a mine, not just demonstrate nor protest, but to stand in the way of a mine. And there's a huge gathering going on this weekend at Copper Falls State Park and in the nearby community of Upson, and we understand in Mellon, and at a new site that the Lacouture tribe has developed. It's called the Lacouture Harvest Camp. There was a unanimous vote of the Lacouture Tribal Council to request of the Iron County Board to establish a camp in the Pinokis to, well, Paul will tell us more about the why of that. And again, there are just a lot of activity up here, and people are saying there will never be a mine in the Pinokis. We're going to find out a bit more about why. Ed, I know you made reference in on your blog on FightingBob.com about a recent article in The New Yorker about the role of the Koch brothers in shaping this country to their liking.
Well, it's amazing, but we can all sort of speculate about what's going to happen in the future, but I think they give us a little peek into the future. David Koch has given over $23 million to public television, for example. And by gosh, there was a coincidence. There was an opening on the board of directors for WNET, and he was willing to serve. So he's going to be on the board. And a documentary has been produced, and some of the people at public television thought they better clear it with David, because it was very, very critical of David Koch. And Jane Mayer, who's written this article, says, here are the Koch brothers. They're trying to buy the Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times, the Baltimore Sun, and other newspapers, and they also want to be able to silence public television, sounds like, because if you can imagine what's happening, the state or the federal government is pulling back on its commitment to public television as usual, and normally that would be... Then we start to have more fundraisers, but what they're looking at here are big contributions in the seven figures from people like David Koch, who will get some say over the editorial content of the deal. So it's kind of scary.
Well, some will remember, and I do, about the time that I began working in public radio was near or just shortly after the election of Ronald Reagan. And he began to cut back enormously the support to public broadcasting. And some of us, again, I entered public broadcasting shortly after the Reagan administration took office. And just as they were slashing funding for public broadcasting, at one time, public broadcasting had enough money, or there was money coming into PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and other sources for producers and for radio stations, where the ability to produce strong news reporting, strong documentaries, strong even investigative reporting, some that simply, with few exceptions, has disappeared. Frontline is one of those, yeah, as you mentioned, one of those which has remained. And apparently that program was critical, or is critical, of the Koch brothers.
Yes, indeed.
And
David Koch apparently did not like that. There's also a piece in Jane Mayer's article that the doorman at his building in New York said he's never given him a tip or a smile, even though he's there quite a bit. And the guy said, in essence, he's a cheapskate. But when it comes to controlling the media, he's not cheap at all. He's willing to spend as much money as needed. And when you think about it, of course, it shouldn't surprise us. I mean, here they are. They own Pulitzer already. They own now they have they own the Baltimore Sun through the LA Times if they get this deal going through. And they will tell us what they want us to think. And they will frame the issues for the debate. And they will tell us who the candidates should be. And I think what we're looking at in the future is just a total loss of democracy in this country.
Well, with rare exception, go ahead, David.
Well, I just wanted to mention here that in the last Nation magazine, Eric Altman wrote a piece about that Koch brothers takeover, intended takeover of the Tribune and company and so and the LA Times, and he was arguing circuitous way, I may agree with him. He was saying that it shouldn't be too alarming because the staffs, the editorial staffs of those papers have already through straw polls indicated that they're just going to be mass resignations if the Koch brothers do buy those papers, which Altman contended would lead to the demise of the papers. Now, as though that were a good thing, I mean, that's obviously not a desirable condition. I wonder, though, if in the minds of the Koch brothers, that isn't their intention, to kill the print media, the large print media.
And either run it or kill it.
Yeah, or kill it by running it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to know. I remember a friend of mine was working at the Baltimore Sun when the L.A. Times swooped in and purchased it, and we thought things would get worse, and they did. And now they're really after all of the major cities in the country. Their news would be coming out to them the way the Koch brothers want it to come out.
Right.
It's very frightening.
But it'll also deflect a lot more attention onto television news, I would guess.
No, it is startling when you consider that most of what more than 95% of what the American public reads or hears or sees comes out of a media owned by just a mere handful of corporate interests in any case. And, of course, national public radio, public television have, to my mind, become increasingly unlikely to challenge in any way the status quo, to be anything of a challenge to the existing order. Now, the Associated Press, that story, the Obama administration, the Eric Holder Justice Department getting phone records of some 100 Associated Press reporters. David, you've been in journalism a long time. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's outrageous, I heard Matt Rothschild yesterday or the day before on Democracy, Amy Goodman's show, suggesting that Eric Holder should resign.
How would we know?
Well, the freedom of the press is always an issue. It always has to be. But the press has been complicit in denying itself freedom. Look at the embedding process that all the big mainstream media has involved itself with in so-called coverage of war, where they become virtual soldiers and don't really report on war. It's outrageous that there would be scrutiny of these AP reporters, considering how basically middle of the road the Associated Press has become over the years. So I think that journalists in general have to be really more than ever independent-minded and pursue their their stories without paying as little attention as possible to the pressures that come from other directions, including the corporate world and the government.
Well, by some measure and analysis, a case in point would be the amount of coverage or the sort of reporting that has been going on regarding the Internal Revenue Service looking into, so it is said by the mainstream press, all of these conservative groups, when by other analysis and closer examination, it appears that only one-third of the applications for 501c4 or this sort of certain nonprofit status were looking into conservative groups. The rest were looking into not what could be defined as not conservative groups. And the IRS has an obligation to look into them. And it seems, from what I have read, and what I hear and understand about it, is the Internal Revenue Service was simply doing what it ought to do, perhaps in a somewhat clumsy fashion, but they were looking for words and phrases that would alert them to the fact that this would be the who they were looking at was a one of these nonprofits with really, really a political aim, like Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS or other Tea Party or Koch Brother associated groups. But that's not getting reported. Meanwhile, somebody like our 7th District Congressman in the northwestern part of the state, Sean Duffy, goes into a rant in a congressional hearing from what I understand it, without any understanding about what's really going on, but simply looking to score some political points and look like a tough guy.
Boy,
I'm stunned by most of this,
Yeah.
But, Ed has often said, you couldn't make this stuff up.
No, it's just unbelievable. But that's what we're looking at, and it seems to me it's hard enough to get a story out now. If you're a progressive candidate running for office. It's hard to get the media to even come to your news conferences or whatever. I remember when I was running for governor, and we called a news conference in Oshkosh, and no reporter showed up from the Daily Northwestern or anyone else. And I called the editor, and I said, what's going on here? He said, well, another candidate was coming into town as well, so we had a choice. We could either cover both or none, and we decided to go with none. And you
really
go out and you say, well, buy the time. Just call our commercial people and buy some 30-second spots.
Yeah,
so
David.
I'm
sorry, Ed.
Sorry, go ahead.
David, several weeks ago, or perhaps a month ago, we talked about drones. You brought in a guest from the organization Veterans for Peace and other affiliations, apparently, to talk about drone warfare. It has become the new norm, hasn't it? President Obama and his administration acknowledging, it's not been just 3 American citizens who've been killed by drones, it's 4. And I suspect that this is simply the way it is, and they'll do nothing to change that. And should we not just simply be outraged that American citizens somewhere else are being targeted extrajudicially, and that they got their trial and now they're dead?
And the use of drones domestically is becoming more and more commonplace and more legitimated too. There's a bill before the Wisconsin legislature, or being drafted, I believe, which would require, which speaks about the use of drones to spy on citizens by law enforcement agencies domestically, but that would require them to have a search warrant before they use the drone. Now, except that in emergency situations or in large crowd scenes or in all sorts of exceptions, which it seems to me that that's just further blurring the line between allowing surveillance of private citizens going about their business right here in Wisconsin through the use of drones. Drones, I think, are kind of a reality that we will have to live with and confront for a time to come.
Well, we shouldn't have any trouble. We'll get those issues before the Supreme Court. They'll take care of us.
I also want to say that I think that the it's great that we're going to have Paul DeMaine on because I've for much of my life advocated on behalf of independent and or alternative press, and every media that can interject itself into the public eye like the work Paul does is critically important as I see it.
Well, let's welcome Paul DeMaine. He's the editor of News from Indian Country and Indian Country TV, and has been very, very busy and active putting together and doing a great amount of historical research as well as investigation into what is going on currently. Paul DeMaine, welcome to Fighting Bob Radio.
Good morning, Eric, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Paul, big doings over in the Pinoki Hills area this weekend, and a whole lot of people involved. There's so much happening, it's hard to know exactly where to start. But I know for one that the Lacoutere tribe, whose tribal chairman Gordon Fayer gave that great speech before the joint session of the assembly in the State of the Tribes address, the Lacoutere tribe voted unanimously to establish what's called a harvest camp out in the Pinokis. Perhaps that's a place to begin with the story today.
It's a place to begin with, all right. I've been dealing with people in and out of my office all morning long as they're preparing to go up there and be good hosts in the Pinoki Hills to all the people who are going to come by that camp in the next few days and take a peek at it. But they're still working on it. I mean, everything is behind a month and a half, 2 months in terms of winter only being over. A couple weeks ago, we were actually working up in snow squalls here, just a couple weeks ago in the woods, middle of May, and down comes the sleet and so forth. So we're a little bit behind on it, but I think that's Mother Nature cooperating with us. And Eric, there is so much going on there. I don't think anyone needs to consider the fact that there's any one event. If you go up into the Pinoki Range area, it's such a beautiful place for camping and recreational activities. And this whole event coming up on Friday night at Bad River, Saturday afternoon at Copper Falls from 11 until 3 o'clock. There's a free concert over in Ups and Down the Road between Mellon and Hurley. There may be some spearing of Lake Galilee on Saturday night if the Chippewa harvesters decide to declare that lake and go up there. Sunday afternoon down at the Dr. Gilmore Park in Mellon, Wisconsin on the Bad River. People are going to be there as well picnicking to be visible because what we found is that there's a tremendous amount of support in that community and within the tribes and in with the region and within the political arena that says this needs to be the Pinoki Range National Heritage Park. Some of us are beyond the verbiage of it ever being an open pit mine, and we're trying to show that there are resources, resources that can sustain people in a very moderate, commercial or self-serving way. That is you can harvest food for yourself out of the Pinoki. So we've got people up there taking an inventory on harvestable products, like they've been bringing in wild onions and hanging them up to see if the place is practically an onion garden from the top of the range to the bottom of the range because of the way the water needs to it doesn't penetrate. It sits, and so you have bodies of water and wild onions. Yellow birch, cedar trees are typically associated with wetlands. They're all the way up the side of the range and on top of the range because of the nature of the water that has nowhere to go but run off. It can't penetrate that iron ore, and so it creates a virtual wetland on top of the earth. And this is where someone thinks you're going to put an open pit mine and not impact the watershed. It's ridiculous if you go up there. In fact, I think GTEC is understanding that they were told to withdraw their request for drilling several boreholes here in the next week or two, because it's wetlands, it's underwater. There's no way they're going to get to that without damaging it. They were told that they weren't able to do those bore core holes, in part because they're virtually on top of a wetland from the bottom to the top of the crest.
Hmm.
Otherwise,
I
was just going to say, otherwise I could list all the wonderful things that are going on there. We've discovered that there's some golden eagles nesting in the range, and we're trying to find where those nests are located. There's people been up there looking for endangered species like turtles, frogs, snails, and my understanding is there's been some success with identifying some fairly rare species up there, and that doesn't surprise me at all, because it's such a pristine area that some of these species would still be up there. So there's been over 150 people through the camp in the last couple of weeks to help out, to help shovel, to help dig, to help clear blaze trails, mark them and everything. And in fact, the Lacouderie tribe passed that resolution, and we went to Iron County officials, and Iron County officials sat down with us and said, basically, you do have a right to harvest under your treaties there. In fact, all citizens have a right to harvest and use that area for recreational use. It's 14 days camping without prior notice in Iron County. And the entire range from one side to the other is either county land or enrolled in the Forest Crop Management Program, which means that all the land on top of the site that is supposed to be this proposed open pit is now open for public recreational harvest and use. And it ought to be why it's still there. I think it's going to be there forever, but people ought to get to know it and understand what a precious gift that already is.
Well, Paul, you've done a lot of research into the history of this area going way back, but the more recent history, for those who may be somewhat fresh to this issue of the proposed iron mine, a strip mine, an open pit mine on the Pinoki Mountains, which is the Mount Whittlesey there is the second highest point in Wisconsin, and it's a range that stretches basically from Mellon, from the headwaters of the Bad River up to Ironwood Hurley, the old deep shaft mining area of northern Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. That company wishing to come in and mine, they said they would ask for no change in law, and lo and behold, within a year, they're asking for a complete change in mining law, which would make actual destruction of the area possible or permissible under this mining law passed recently. The tribes are standing four square against it. The jobs have been promised by the mining company, some 700. The people in the region, as you've told, I know, for example, the mayor of Mellon was at one time saying, you know, this could be a good idea. He's changed his mind, and so have many others.
I think that's clearly what has happened here. There's such a big difference, and I think that once people sat down, even in Hurley, people who wanted this mine so badly and sat down and says, well, there were, for example, even after this new legislation passed with Authorize, which would be the world's largest open pit mine, it would be 22 miles, and the mining company officials say, well, we're going to backfill, so it ain't going to be an open pit 22 miles long. But that whole scheme is even creating issues because, Iron County officials apparently didn't know that whatever gets taken out of pit number one doesn't apparently go back into that pit. Pit number one is filled with pit number two, pit number three, blah, 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 down the line. So they backfill, and at the end of this thing, somewhere over toward Clam Lake, there will be a 4-mile-long beautiful lake, as they say. Like, we need, people don't realize we already have the most beautiful lake on Lake Superior, and there's lakes all over the place, but this mining company is going to gift us this. The thing is that I've been up there to see the head, whatever they call them, the head something another for the elevators and shafts that went in. You have a shaft mine that goes in, and there's a hole in the ground no bigger than your 2-lane highway out there, and they go in and they take these rich veins of ore out. Versus this open pit concept, and I think people are only beginning to realize it. There was Iron County officials who did not know where this mine was even going to go. They hadn't been down to that area of the county because it's way over there, kind of a thing. And so as people are beginning to go and find out the specifics about what this company has, in mind. I think they haven't reserved judgment. They're kind of pissed off at the process, the taxation issue. The Democrats offered 18 amendments based on what they heard from local people, from mining, pro-mining people. You know, and for pro-mining people to be getting knocked on the table and saying, look, you got 2 minutes or you got 10 minutes or we already made our mind up. Just tell us what you think. We're going to pass this bill and it's the form that the mining company give it because we're so rushed to get this jobs on the line that we don't even care about the environment. We don't care about people in Iron County, really. What we want to do is make sure that we do what's right in order to pay back the people that gave us these big political contributions and they know best. Trust them. And people don't trust them. People in northern Wisconsin are kind of some pretty hardcore people that live up there anyway. They don't trust a whole lot of things, let alone a mining interest from West Virginia owned by a guy in Florida, from a corporation from Ontario, Canada, that might be backed by the Chinese. Sorry. They're not going to tell us how northern Wisconsin is going to like this.
Ed, the money in this, Ed, has been the flag. It's a flag that you've been raising for as long as you've been in a political life.
Well, that's right. You know, they never want to tell you what they're really doing because you don't have the right to know. When you listen to, for example, what's going on in South Milwaukee, where they create mining equipment, now that plant has been purchased by Caterpillar, you can bet that they're going to be putting pressure on to go forward with the mine so they can create the equipment that will create jobs that will help the economy. And it's just absolute nonsense. But every aspect of this is covered. They've got so many lobbyists.
But Ed, let me ask this question. At Caterpillar, by understanding there was a strike that the company got concessions out of workers in Milwaukee and out of the union. At the same time, Caterpillar had record profits in the company. So tell
right.
me how that you can do that. And now, if this is supposed to benefit Caterpillar that much more, and they're all happy about it, why are they treating their workers that way? This is what's going on all the way down the line. People are told this is the way it's got to be. And there's a handful of people up in Iron and Ashland County that are running around with these great big blow-ups of checks with dollar bills, and there's a few people who like that dollar bill thing, but frankly, when you get up there and speak to them, they're concerned about the relationships with the neighbors, they're concerned about what they've done to the tribes, they're concerned about the fact that they've been dissed, and people who are pro-mining up there, are beginning to say, we're not sure if this is what we want. So I keep saying we're waiting for the courage for a group of people to come together to introduce legislation at the state or federal level, which would create the Pinocchio Hills National Heritage Park, look at self-sustaining jobs that create jobs for 1,000 years, even if they're only $25,000 or $30,000 rather than whatever figure people are throwing out there, $70,000 and $80,000 and $100,000. Create those jobs for 1,000 years rather than 25, 30 years of extractive industry in which an industry comes in and goes out. Right. You want me to go up and show you all kinds of foundations? I found a beautiful foundation of a school that used to be there that built when there was a lot of people there, and they all came and went. And if you don't think they're going to come and go again, then you're acting pretty foolish. And what I find is that I have been up there the last 6 or 7 weeks dealing with people in bars and convenience stores. And, yeah, I find some people who think it might be good for the community. And there's some people that got dollar bills. But for the most part, people up there, I think, are refreshed at the idea that this area is getting that focus and it may bring tourism dollars that it's never brought before. And we want to show that there's a heavy economic stimulus. I go up there every summer. I spend money. I'm not going to go up there to look at Mount Whittlesey, which people argue about it. It's third, fourth, or second highest place in the state of Wisconsin, and look down 1,000 feet into a pit and say, that used to be Mount Whittlesey, one of the most beautiful places there is, but it's down there now because these guys wanted to extract something. If anyone believes they're extracting iron ore up there, all the neighbors up there think that those guys are looking at – the residual ores, the silvers and the coppers and the golds, and they're going to say, well, that surprises. We didn't know it was there. Everyone up there knows it's up there, and they know that it's not viable in a shaft mine to mine the copper, silver, or gold. But if you do an open pit and just accidentally kind of come across and eat everything up, you'll get what you want a lot easier. So there's a lot of people in the neighborhood up there that really think this mining company is after the residual ores rather than the iron ore, which right now prices are very low, and it's controlled by the Chinese for the most part, the entire industry.
It's very reminiscent of the Ladysmith mine, where the Kennecott Corporation took out some $400+ million in gold, not what they were looking for. Whoops, we just, they shipped that off before
like
anybody was
looking.
Machine.
It's like putting a slot machine in a bathroom stall and then going, oh, my God, I didn't know we were going to make money off of it. You know, whoops, exactly. You know, the one-armed bandit made money. Wow, it made a lot of money. Whoops, that was an accident. We didn't know that. Eric, you wanted me to talk a little bit about the history real quick.
I would love to hear you talk about the history. You've got you've produced some just incredible maps and a detail of that region and discovered, the sort of thing which would, it would seem, qualify the region for a National Heritage Historical Site. It's amazing.
Let's give the sites to Indian Country TV. TV, just the way it is, .com is the site where you can find lots of the videos in the library on the second page. IndianCountryNews.com, which is our news website, has a lot of those videos as well on the front page or on the TV page. They're called Defending Clean Water, and those are the pictures and slides and video programs that are coming out of the Pinokies right now, and we'll be doing some of the history stuff there. But, for example, in the northern Wisconsin mining range, I don't know exactly where they found these tools, but the oldest tools that have been found in the ancient mines running from southern Douglas County through the Namekagon Lakes area up into the Pinoki Range and up to Keweenaw Bay has been dated at 260 A.D., almost 2,000 years ago. And that tool was a maul that had a groove. It was a great big roundish type of piece of rock that had a groove in the middle of it and some kind of a vine tied, almost like binder twine, several cords of that vine tied around it. So what you had is a swinging maul. And they found several of these broken mauls in some of these pits that were like 24 feet deep. Very old and ancient tools, 260 A.D., on the Indian trails, we find the Ironton Trail, which was an Indian trail way before any white man came and discovered the area, led right into the Pinoki Range and then up to a trail that went from Tyler Forks and the Moore Park Road area where the LCO Harvest Camp is, over to as far as Pinoki, and Pinoki is the gap that the Bad River flows north through the Pinoki Range on its way to the Lake Superior. So the watershed on both sides of the Pinoki Range, even though it's on the south side, flows through the Pinoki Gap southwest of Mellon and up through the Bad River Lake Superior. That's an ancient mining area that we found evidence of what you call, some people call it half-breed copper, some people call it spotted copper. That's silver droplets that fell into the copper as it cooled so that it's not an inset. They've got artwork that they found in East St. Louis at the Cahokia Mound, Hopewellian people there, and in other places of the country. That spotted silver, spotted copper is found and unique to the Pinoki Range and that particular lava flow that went down on the earth a million years ago or whenever it was before it was turned sideways. So we have ancient evidence of people utilizing this entire range for copper and silver and other ornaments. Those ornaments have been traded and bartered all over the world. You find them in East St. Louis in the Ohio Valley and other places, and you find turquoise in the burials of some of these 7.5, almost 8 foot tall people that in many tribal societies were described as giants. And these people subjugated other people. They were in a palisaded community. There's the Aztalan site, I think, in Rock County in southern Wisconsin that's associated with them. At Lakota Ray here, we have some people on Peninsula Road or Thoroughfare Road on the peninsula by reserve where there were several mounds, and they've been found there, and they've been found up in the Keweenaw Bay area, and they were miners. They were the entrepreneurs, and they probably had people who they subjugated who worked those mines. So we're looking for their villages in the Pinoki Range. We're looking for their burial grounds. We're looking for the places that our tribal people visited, even into the contemporary Ojibwe history, which goes back, you know, 700 to 800 years. And they did use copper for hooks and other things, but not very extensively. Actually, the Ojibwe people were more reverence toward the spiritual nature of copper than they were miners of the copper. The actual miners of that copper came from societies and people before then. So you have, it's interesting, I've looked at the old Holmes mine shaft there. It was 248 feet. They did find gold there. It's closed up and buried now. It was never able to produce enough revenue to keep the company sustainable, which is similar to most of the mines up there, the silver, the copper, and the gold mines for the most part. Once they took out the big chunks, there's not enough left to sustain it. So you had shaft mining in areas for some of those minerals until they pretty much tapped them out or couldn't afford to get them anymore. We're looking for some of those ancient mines. We're looking for people who know about other artifacts that have been picked up in that area. If they've ever seen any, get a hold of us because we want to explore it. That qualifies it for a heritage park all by itself. I mean, it had a logging era as well in the area, out of the Mellon area, but this whole ancient and then more contemporary historical Ojibwe mining and spiritual sites, and then you have your contemporary mining shafts, and now you got this attempt at open pit that's not going to happen, but I think a changeover. I've taken people up there and spent the day driving around just giving them history of Ojibwe, Dakota battles, mining and stuff like that, and spent the day. I could fill 4 or 5 days up, and if we could bring foreign tourists from Germany over here and Japanese tourists and stuff like that, they'd love the Indians. They've loved the history of the area, and they would fall in love with the people, and the people up there will love what's going on because they don't have to move away because of the dust and explosion and lights from the open pit. They can stay right where they are and love that land. So, yes, it ought to be a heritage park.
Well, Paul, Governor Scott Walker and I recall during his campaign, Tommy Thompson, you know, said, "Gee, we were Badgers once. This is the Badger State. We have a long tradition of this wooden mining in the Pinokies by his lights. Simply continue that great tradition in Wisconsin of being Badgers and miners."
Okay. I'd like to see Scott Walker or any of these guys go down into one of these little old traditional heritage mines that was their heritage and work it for a little while because it was dangerous from all kinds of health purposes. There's families up there who can tell you personally, relatives who've passed away from different kinds of cancers, lung diseases, accidents, and so forth. That goes along with this beautiful heritage. When you don't have to go into a shaft mine, it's such a wonderful thing. But anyway, yeah, we know about why Wisconsin got this name and everything. And yes, there probably will be some mining in Wisconsin. It's going to be essential. It's going to be essential to take iron ore somewhere, maybe, until people start figuring out that if they recycle the dumps of Ashland, Superior, and a few other places, would probably equivalent to whatever they're going to take out of the Pinoki Hills. They could just remine some of these old dumps in Wisconsin and probably get as much ore out of it. And you want to remember that the Bad River Elders says, you know, it's got to do with risk factors. If the United States was at war and they couldn't get the iron ore they needed, the Bad River Elders says maybe the risk, we would be willing to take that risk to our rice and our walleye and other things that are downstream if it was essential. If we needed to give that up to preserve the country, we'd be willing to do it. But the risk for Chris Klein and an out-of-state mining company is not worth it, and it's not going to happen. And that's the message they laid out right away. And right now, I'll paint this little scenario. When we were in Madison during the mining legislation, someone says, "Well, where are all the warriors?" Well, you know what's here? These are our elders. here's the women who are fighting for protection of the water. It's about the water, ultimately, making sure that water is clean and drinkable. And you have your politicians like Mike Wiggin trying to make his stand on reasonable grounds having to do with the environment and other issues and so forth. That was all a political, social thing. It was very cordial. If anyone got afraid of the Indians in Madison, it's because they don't know Native people well enough not to be afraid of the sound. You know, this Kramer guy walked out of the assembly all disgusted and so forth at what Gordon Thayer had to say. But the thing is that was their turf. Our warriors weren't there, you know.
Yeah.
So when they come to our area, that's our turf. And I can tell you that with the number of veterans in our community, the number of Vietnam vets and Korean vets and everything else vets that hunt and fish to make their family survive, mining couple officials are now on our turf. It's all, you know, pretty much what I can say about it. LCO has a harvest camp, but that's the Lakota people. That doesn't include all the other people that are being mobilized that have ideas about how they want to preserve this area. But I can tell you this, that our warriors are up there, and when the elders said this mine will not go in, I'm sorry, folks. It's like when Hillary Walker said over his dead body, would there be uranium deposit or radioactive waste dump site in northern Wisconsin. He got off his deathbed after a heart attack and said that, you know what, the Menominee Warrior Society and everyone else on that reservation was ready to implement his words because Hillary Walker, the elder, said that over my dead body, that radioactive waste dump site's going to go in. The elders at Bad River said that mine's not going to happen. I hope that GTAC people can hear what the elders said, because now we're at that point where the line's been drawn in the sand. Madison was that mining company's turf where they could pour money into the pockets of Republicans and get whatever they want. But now they have to deal with the people that live in Iron County and the tribal people around them. That's their turf. They need to be wary of it. And when Bill Williams says they found a knapsack, you know, stuff between a newspaper vending machine and a thing, and they called in all, well, Sean Duffy was in town, so they called the bomb squad out to Wausau. They blocked off the whole Hurley was blocked off. It was closed down for most of the day. Why, they found out that there was a peanut butter sandwich and some small smidgen of marijuana in this knapsack that someone had stuffed there. They're afraid. It shows you how paranoid they are, and they ought to be, because they are out of place people in our community at this point. And I can tell you that I've been in the bars, I've been in the restaurants of Mellon and some of the other places up there, and right now I haven't found anyone to argue with about. There's some people saying, well, I'm kind of for it, I'm kind of against it, maybe we'll see what happens, you know. Well, I'm finding lots of people who says we don't want this thing up here, and they didn't hear us. When they came to Hurley, they didn't hear 780 people out of the 900 people who said we didn't want that mine. They couldn't hear us. They were being paid too much money, these Republican legislators. They couldn't hear Iron County non-Indians. This is not just an Indian thing. When the newspapers say, well, the Bad River tribe stands in the way of jobs, it's not Bad River, it's all 11 Wisconsin tribes. It's people from Iron County, Ashen County, and even the people who are business people and want jobs are leery of it because they're just beginning to understand how massively impactive this thing will be to their community for 30 years until they pull out, and then they can take care of the mess after it.
It's a startling story. Isn't it, Ed? Yeah. You're listening to Fighting Bob Radio. I'm Eric Schubringer, the host of and the founder.
We didn't even talk about the allotments.
FightingBob.com. Well, we're not done yet. Ed, this is a remarkable part of the story, as I've come to understand it, which is there were the treaties of 1837, 42, 1854, the Allotment Act, Dawes Act in the 1890s, where... explain it to us, Paul, in about the Pinokis and allotments or land that was granted, given, traded for tribal members.
Let's talk about it in a very personal way, and I'm going to personalize it this way. My great-great-great-great-grandfather, I'm going to call him my great-grandfather five times, had an 80-acre allotment just southeast of Mellon, Wisconsin. Elizabeth Trudell a relative. We don't quite know how she's related to John Trudell yet. It might be a great-great-great-great-grandmother. I like the idea that maybe John Morrison and Elizabeth Trudell were, you know, having an affair on the side of it. Anyway, she got a 160-acre allotment as a under what they call souscript. You want to remember that back in the 1800s, the U.S. government was trying to conquer and divide, just like Scott Walker does real well nowadays, the half-breeds and mixed bloods from the true Indians. The true Indians were kind of like really dark, complected, you know, and they spoke Ojibwe and they were Madewan. Those tribal people who wanted to stay in Wisconsin under the Treaty of 1854, and you want to remember there was 3742, Forest Treaty, Mineral Treaty, 1854, we're going to be allowed to stay in Wisconsin Treaty, if the Indians go to the reservation. The mixed bloods, like my great-great-grandfather, John Morrison, was a postmaster in 1850 on Madeline Island. He was educated. He was the son of former stockholders of fur trade companies and railroad companies and ships and steamships and all that. And several of the Morrisons were very business-minded, but they had native wives, and so their children were educated. They were Episcopalian Catholics and educated Madewan people, actually. But John Morrison, under the 1854 treaty, had a right to either do two things. He could choose to go to the Bad River Reservation, where a BI agent would take his annuity payment, pay his debts, and give him what was left over and tell him what to do. You can get up, you can go to sleep at this time, you got permission to leave the reservation. Or he could become a good U.S. citizen, like the U.S. government was trying to say. You're a half-breed, you're not like them, you need to get your 80-acre homestead script. But in the secession of the lands in northern Wisconsin, the chief said, these are our children and our grandchildren and our nieces and nephews, and they have a right to be compensated for the loss of their property in northern Wisconsin properly. Now, you're going to pay annuities to all the quote-unquote real Indians, but these half-breeds, which the U.S. government kept trying to divide off from as not really being Indians, had a right to choose their allotment and settle down. John Morrison chose an 80-acre allotment up in that range, as did over 250 other mixed breeds throughout that, Copper Falls, Iron County, Ashland County. There's a whole area up there, 30, 40,000 acres of land was allotted and given to Indian people to settle down. The mining company and prospectors come in there, and this is real interesting, says, you know, we can get control of this. We can get control of the souscript and these other lands if we keep these ugly, this is the thing that hurts, they call this ugly, these hostile and ugly Indians. Can you imagine that? They're talking about Bad River Indians, not LCO Indians, by the way. And if we bring in the people from Maine and squat on that land under some 1832 or 1828 iron or mineral squatting law, you go out there and you stake it down and you claim 5 or 6 acres and you work it for 2 years and you get title to it. And the mining company from Maine brings in all these people because they say, if we can hold the Indians at bay, we can squat on it and get this land. So first of all, on my grandpa's 80-acre allotment, there's 15 to 20 white guys who think that there's gold, silver, and copper there. And they, you know, John Morrison, you want to go down to your allotment and check on it? There's 20 white guys with guns down who think they're going to be millionaires someday because there's copper gold under this law, and you are a half-breed who they're going to respect and say, would you move off my 80-acre allotment? Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, John Morrison would have been dead. And the state of Wisconsin did what it did on SB1, AB1 in 1859, and what they did is they created by Congressional Act 63 a corporation called the Pinocchio Hills Corporation, blah, 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 and they assigned them a whole bunch of lands. If they put up a school, they'd get a one-mile square area. They assign lands, which I suspect, when we compare the descriptions, are going to be the same lands that the allotments are, because that's where the ore deposit was as well. So you have a state and federal rights conflict leading into the Civil War. You've got white guys squatting on. They brought in 800 or 900 people from the East Coast to squat on these lands that were Indian allotments. And by the 1880s and 1890s, most of these people had done what my great-grandpa did through an attorney who got the power to represent him, is to get what they could out of the land, because he was never going to go be able to homestead that land because there was other people squatting on it. The state of Wisconsin and the mining companies won out again. Out-of-state monies ripped my great-grandfather's allotment off, And he did settle for something, but I'm not sure what we're going to find with all the other 200 allotments. We're finding murder victims up there already, and I think before we're over, we're going to find more of it. What it is another atrocious situation in which tribal people trying to be good U.S. citizens like they're being told to do were ripped off their property a second time after the treaty already took it away at 13 cents or 11 cents an acre, whatever it was. So that gets us up into the 1890s, and there's some lawsuits over it in the 1900s, and of course the judge says, if I undo this allotment, I have to undo all this scurrilous illegal stuff. Sorry, they should have filed years ago, latches, adverse possession, the mining companies win, and John Morrison just gets his settlement for whatever it was. That's history. I intend to go up there this summer sometime, and I'm going to take a couple stakes and put them in the ground, and I'm going to call the press and media, and I'm going to have them, invite them up there. I'm going to say, see these stakes? I'm going to unstake those miners' claims and throw those stakes away, because if the guy can stake it down and claim the land and get it, I can unstake the land and get it back. Uh-huh. And then I'm going to donate it to the Pinocchio Hills National Heritage Park for the public to enjoy in perpetuity. Okay?
That's
as simple
time.
As that. There might be clouded title. There may be lawsuits. There may be other things going on here. We don't know where that's going to lead, but it's one of many. It's like the golden eagles we know that are up there. We want to find where their nest is, because I suspect there's a nest right on top of the ore deposit, and it'll be a golden eagle that'll bring that potential mine to a grinding halt just like that. Boom, it'll be over with, because Mother Nature's cooperating with us. She agrees with us that we need to help protect that forever.
Paul, you've got some remarkable maps. Are those available on your website as well? Can people see them, where these allotments
were? I haven't put them up. Well, I did put a little bit up. They're mainly at the Facebook page at the Citizens Concerned About the Pinocchio Hills. They aren't at our website, but I'm going to try to get them up there and arrange them. I just got them in hard copy form because, Eric, actually all this stuff has only happened in the last few weeks. We had someone mapping some stuff. He came across some allotments for Chippewas. Then we came across some Sioux allotments, which was astounding in regards to the historic nature of them, because the closest Dakota people are in southern Minnesota in the 1850s and 60s, and being pushed even further west. But these represent mixed blood. So we will be getting stuff up on that if people are interested. We have some attorneys looking at it. I got extra copies that I'm handing out. I'll try to get something up soon. I got to breathe, Eric.
Ed, what do you think about all of this, the picture
well,
of this this territory? It's incredible.
I think that Paul obviously is on the right track, and what we have to make sure we can do is capture the essence of what he has just spent an hour talking about so that people will understand what's going on. I find that the ignorance of people in terms of our history and what happened, whether it's 1837 or 1854 or whatever, you'd almost believe that some think that the somehow or other last year people came over and took the land, and of course we know that's silly. But it's awfully hard to explain all of this to people without a video and without seminars. I guess would be the best way to put it.
Right.
I think we have a duty to educate.
Paul, thank you very much for being
with
us
Paul.
Today.
That's
okay,
terrific.
I'll bow out. You guys take care. We'll talk again sometime.
Thank you, Paul.
Be well. Yeah. Paul Demain is the editor of News from Indian Country and doing vast research on this, along with surely many others, into the history of the Pinocchios. A fascinating one. I should, Ed and David, I know you're there. Paul ran this, showed me this one day, just an extensive series of maps, a large one down to the next, to demonstrate that yes, there were communities in the area where the now Le Coudray harvest camp is. And I had no idea, as he said, just in the past weeks has some of this come to light, this history been revealed about that area where, 800 miners or persons were brought by mining companies to squat on the land that was held by tribal members or half-breed tribal members, if you will, in order to displace them from it. And here we come again. Does it never stop?
Yeah.
You know, we seem to be in this endless cycle of what can only be described as, you know, corporate abuse of persons, of real persons.
And let's not ever forget that these corporations spend a lot of money on lobbyists and publicists and people who are trying to convince people that they're right and that this is going to create jobs, it's going to be wonderful, and these bad guys are getting in the way of millions of dollars of salaries. It's just complete nonsense, but there you have it.
And one of the things that was published that I received recently, the Iron County Forestry Department and its tourism area, its outdoor recreation plan, actually just an excellent view of what could happen in that region. And this was created before, I think in 2010 or earlier, 2008 in fact, a long-term look at how that region could be used for outdoor recreation. And apparently many persons in that area are revisiting that as a far better idea than returning to a mining district. It is.
There's so much information. I actually feel overwhelmed. I'm not sure what to say at this point, except that I'm going to have to spend some time figuring out what's going on here so we can interpret it for other people.
I think it's
Paul
really Paul DeMaine's conversation and the research that's being done up there is really important, and the fact that history repeats itself is questionable in my mind, because it isn't the kind of mining that the native people did nearly 2,000 years ago that Paul was talking about was really a cultural necessity. It was part of their spiritual life, as he kept referring to it. It had all these, all sorts of connotations that were part and parcel of indigenous people's culture. And it's absolutely valid to point out that a multinational corporation with you know, for probably tax dodging reasons and all sorts of other reasons, it has headquarters everywhere from Canada to China to the United States. The comparison is just invalid. It's so ludicrous that we shouldn't even be considering seriously the requests that are being placed on with our state by Gogebic Taconite. They seem ridiculous when we really hear about them and understand them. But nonetheless, our legislators take them seriously and expect the rest of us to take them seriously as well.
Yeah. We've talked occasionally on the program about frac sand mining, and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign has come up with some numbers that indicate that a huge amount of money came into the state, Republican mostly, but other candidates for office in Wisconsin from the frac sand and the hydraulic fracking industry. The money comes in and politicians respond according to who their paymasters seem to be. Yeah, when I say, you know, sort of revisiting the past, David, it is that once upon a time the corporate interests from somewhere else, from outside, came to exploit this region and take the land from the people who lived here for their benefit and for none of ours. I'm reminded, too, of Chris Hedges, along with his co-author and artist Joe Flacco, I believe his name, wrote a book recently about sacrifice zones in the United States, whether it's Indian Pine Ridge Reservation out in the eastern Camden, New Jersey, or the mountaintop coal mining regions, areas where coal mining is done with mountaintop removal in Tennessee and in West Virginia, that this area of Northwest Wisconsin, this idea by this mining company, Gogebic Taconite, looks very much the same to me. They're willing to sacrifice this region for their profit with no regard
to
the people here.
Simple as that.
Yeah, it seems clearly that. Let's talk next about, we've got about a minute left. It's great to get so much information from Paul. Fighting Bob Fest, September 7th. We want to let people remember the date.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. We've got to have a huge crowd because, I'll tell you what, we're under assault by the Walker people and the Koch brothers, and we've got to come up with some plan of action that gets us beyond the way the governor has treated working people, the way the legislature is passing bills that make no sense to anybody except the lobbyists who are paying them. Same-day loan companies are going to have to be regulated. We really need to have a game plan that's not been provided thus far by the Democratic Party. It's going to have to come from the progressive movement, and we've got to do it quickly.
We do indeed. And, well, with that, I guess we need close. You've been listening to Fighting Bob Radio. I'm Eric Schubert. Ed Garvey, founder of Fighting
Thank
Bob.
Thank you very much, Eric.
The Fighting Bob Festival on September the 7th. And journalist David Giffey, look for his work at fightingbob.com and everywhere else. Evidence.
Happy Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day. Be well.